welcome to She Thinks, a podcast where you're allowed to think for yourself. I'm your host, Beverly Hallberg. And on today's episode, it is our policy focus, this one entitled The Current State of Laws Governing Gender Transitions. In our discussion, we're going to dive into the transgender culture war and how it's resulted in a patchwork of conflicting legislation governing so-called gender transitions for minors. We're also going to look at the current state of affairs and why ideology trumps studies that urge caution. And joining us to talk about it all is the author of this month's policy focus, Madeline Kearns, joins us. She is a senior fellow at IWF, a staff writer at National Review, and a contributor to The Spectator. She has written for The Wall Street Journal and The Daily Telegraph, among others, and has appeared on the BBC, Fox News, and Ben Shapiro Show. Madeline, a pleasure to have you on She Thinks.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to break it all down here, but I want to let our listeners know if you're interested in looking at this policy focus, you can go to IWF.org. Again, it is entitled Current State of Laws Governing Gender Transitions. There are so many cases that are outlined in here, what states are doing. But again, we're going to break it down here. And so, Madeline, I want to start with you on the history of what used to be referred to as gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria used to be treated as a mental illness. Can you give us just some detail on what people with gender confusion used to receive as treatment?
Yeah, so the first thing probably to point out would be that the term gender dysphoria is really a very new diagnostic criteria that we use to define this. So that comes from the 2013 edition of the DSM, that's DSM-5. Before then, it was known as gender identity disorder. And the whole concept of having a gender identity, that is an inner sense of being male or female or something else entirely, is a completely novel 20th century idea that originated in the field of psychology and sexology in the 20th century in America. So that's when this theory, this idea, it's not proven, it's actually not even provable, this idea that we all have an inner gender identity started to emerge. It was pioneered by a sexologist called John Money, who did a very famous twin study involving two males, young males, one of whom had had his penis damaged in a botched circumcision as an infant and was raised as a girl. That had very tragic outcomes, and the young man in question, who was raised as a girl, revolted against this and later found out that he was a boy and lived a life and was very unhappy and eventually killed himself due to some of these issues. So the whole thing from the beginning, this idea of gender identity was really a theory. It wasn't proven. But what is true is there have always been people for whom their sex characteristics have caused great distress. And so the way that psychiatry and psychology tried to deal with this was along this line of this theory of gender identity. And so what happened was, you know, it was a fairly common sense approach. You know, you can't change your sex. That was generally accepted. At least it was accepted, you know, prior to the 1970s, this idea that you cannot change your sex. And so the best thing that anybody could possibly do for you is to really get to the root cause of what's causing this distress. Why is it that you feel at odds with your biology? And maybe exploring that through talk therapy, through counselling, just kind of common sense things. This was a very rare condition. It was rare in adults, and it was even rarer still in children. Most of the children who presented with this were little boys. And a lot of them, when treated in this way, just the talk therapy basically, would by the end of adolescence grow out of these feelings. The vast majority would. A lot of those young boys would actually grow up to be same-sex attracted. You know, so it was kind of the common sense approach. What changed? Well, what changed really was technology. So the first thing that changed was, you know, in the 1950s, there were sort of early experiments with surgeries and things. You know, you can find a few examples going further back than that of doctors who really tried these completely novel, very high risk surgeries, trying to change the anatomy of people who were at odds, feeling at odds with their sex. So the technology changed and it changed and was experimented, you know, through the 1970s. There was Johns Hopkins University, which famously shut down these so-called sex change experiments because there wasn't the data there to prove that they were making people any happier, that they were really resolving these underlying issues. But the second big change that happened in terms of medical technology was in the 1990s, when endocrinologists started experimenting with so-called puberty blockers. And this really happened in Holland. It was known as the Dutch Protocol. And so the theory behind it was, well, if we give these mostly young boys who are feeling very distressed by their sex, if we give them puberty blockers, if we delay the onset of puberty, we'll buy them more time to make up their mind about whether they really want to be the opposite sex or not. Of course, that isn't actually what ended up happening. If you delay puberty, it isn't a neutral thing. It's not neutral physically because you've delayed the development of somebody's body. You know, we now have surgeons who do these so-called sex change or gender affirmation surgeries, saying that actually when they're operating on young people who have had these puberty blockers, there's not enough penile tissue to make a successful operation. So there's all sorts of physical problems associated with this, also unknown things to do with bone density and so on. But the other issue is actually psychological. If you interrupt somebody's puberty, they're far likelier to remain in this state of distress with their body. They're more likely to accept their body if you let them go through natural puberty. So what really happened was that, you know, that was an experiment, and it's right to call it an experiment, that happened in the 1990s. And some ideologues, clinical activists, I think it's fair to call them that, in the United States saw this and thought, wow, we could really do something similar here. And so they started doing similar things in the United States in the early 2000s. And meanwhile, the ideology and the ideological claims morphed into not simply this is a way that we could help people who feel at odds with their sex, but this is a way that we could let people be their true selves, their true gender identity. So it really started as this sort of obscure niche, very out there experiment in Europe, and became this one size fits all, that people talk about puberty blockers being a pause button. It's more like a nuclear button. Let's do the most radical thing possible, and let's recommend it widely. And so that's really what's happened in the United States.
Yeah, and a couple questions for you on that. So with the Dutch studies, you referred to that. It was puberty blockers only. There were no medical treatments, correct? There weren't surgeries.
That's right. Yeah, you were simply talking about the puberty blockers. And then naturally what, of course, happened is at a certain point when you're deciding what to do next, you will recommend the cross-sex hormones. So it's really a four-stage thing. You know, the first stage is social transition. That's treating the child as though they really are the sex with which they identify, which is not a neutral thing. It's a psychological treatment. And then it's the puberty blockers, which stops your natural puberty from happening. Then it's the cross-sex hormones, which gives you the puberty experience of the opposite sex. And then finally, it's surgical modifications to your sex characteristics.
And I want to go back to the way this was treated before. You used the word, this was extremely rare that somebody would struggle with their sex. What do you say to critics that, well, that is because it wasn't accepted? Someone was thought of as crazy as having a mental illness if they talked about this. What do you say to that?
Well, what I would say to that is, if that were true, you would not have expected the bizarre and otherwise inexplicable, except for the argument of social contagion, demographic changes. So if it were true that simply people needed to be better accepted, and once you better accept them, these people come forward, they were always there, they're just more confident now to come forward, why would you see suddenly adolescent teenage girls with no prior history of gender confusion suddenly developing it in adolescence in peer settings where a large proportion of their peer group or their social group have also experienced it. How can you explain the change in demographic from little boys, mostly little boys, who most of whom would actually turn out to be same-sex attracted, to these this completely different demographic? You can't really support that with the evidence. It's a nice idea, but it's just not what we're dealing with.
One of the things that has surprised me most about this movement is I was referred to as a tomboy growing up, and I know a lot of girls refer to as tomboys because they like to be part of sports. Some boys like to be in theater or dance. And so there's this, it used to be acceptable that you weren't in a stereotypical girl or boy role. It seems that for years we were taught, be who you are, love who you are. That was the motto we heard. And now it's, you shouldn't love your body if you like sports and you're a girl, or you shouldn't like your body if you're a boy who likes to dance. You must be the wrong sex. How do they square the fact that the liberal side teach that you need to love who you are, but yet they want to medically change you?
So the way they get around that is this, to go back to this theory, because it really is just a theory of gender identity. And this is really, it's more like a metaphysical claim than it is a biological one. This idea that you have this inner sense, almost like a soul, that tells you what you really are, what you truly are, and your body can get in the way of that. So it's basically saying that your inner sense, your inner soul is more important than your body, is more dominant than your body. And so therefore we have to make all these changes to your body potentially. Now you're absolutely right in pointing out, though, that's just the worst message you could possibly send to teenagers. And if you think about this in other contexts, we would never do that. We would never say to the anorexic teenage girl, your inner sense that you're really overweight, that's the one we should listen to. Let's go ahead and starve your body. Of course we wouldn't do that. You know, the message should be exactly as you're saying. Listen, we all have our bodies, and everybody's is a bit different. And you don't need to conform your life to stereotypes. There's a wide range of diversity in how you can express yourself. And in a tolerant society, that should be fine. To take that and take the idea and say we're going to reinforce these body image issues that you're having, we're going to medically facilitate changes in pursuit of something, and this is the critical point, in pursuit of something impossible, because it really is impossible to change your sex. It's just, we wouldn't do this in any other context, and we would recognize it as being completely insane in any other context.
And there's another side of this too, which is I think everybody would admit that puberty was such an awkward stage. None of us enjoyed puberty. You don't know what's going on. You don't feel comfortable in your own body. And it seems that that is when we see a lot of young people say that their identity doesn't match. Of course, that's why you would have puberty blockers. I know puberty blockers are often given at a child, maybe 6, 7, 8 years old. It's maybe when sex hormones are treated. Why aren't we just telling children it's an awkward stage? Let's just wait and see. Let's wait, give yourself some time. Why isn't there this approach of caution, especially when I believe the data point is 94% of young people who do struggle with identity of their gender, or gender dysphoria, I should say, they grow out of it as they leave puberty and enter adulthood.
Well, I mean, what you're articulating is the total common sense position, isn't it? That we, not just because of what we know about what these drugs can do and how unsatisfactory the long-term results are and how damaging the long-term risks are in terms of your sexual functioning, in terms of your fertility, but also just what we know about children, what we know about teenagers. We know that they can have these high highs and these low lows, your body's changing. I think especially for young women, it can be an ordeal in terms of figuring out periods and also sexual attention that you didn't have before, which comes with the development of breasts. And these are all things that are difficult, and they're especially difficult in our very hyper online age, where people are growing up with phones and Instagram and all the pressure and social pressure that comes with that. You're absolutely right that the way to be dealing with this is by taking a constructive, common sense approach and just talking to children honestly about the difficulties of these changes, but, you know, cautioning them from making these really radical decisions, and actually in some cases preventing them from doing that. You know, we prevent children from having tattoos, we prevent them from drinking. There's all sorts of things that are actually much less damaging than these drugs and these surgeries that we already apply this common sense mentality to.
I want to talk now about how the medical community has approached this. In addition to that Dutch study you mentioned, there have been other international independent studies that have urged caution, have said that the results haven't been as good as what some would have hoped, that this can actually be damaging. It seems that the medical community is ignoring the normal studies they would be paying attention to. For example, a typical clinical approach or standard of care is to develop a response in light of evidence and established by consensus. But the typical medical methods seem to be thrown out the window.
Yeah, and that's another big part of this story. And in fact, what you've seen in Europe, where the healthcare model there is much more naturally risk averse because they have sort of limited resources and it's publicly funded and available for public scrutiny, they've been pointing out, well, wait a minute here, we don't have the evidence to support this. And in fact, the burden of proof that this is a good idea has to fall on the people suggesting it, right? Because what we were doing was safe, it had high rates of efficacy, it could be supported by the evidence. You know, you said that 94%, that's pretty darn good. So the people coming in and wanting to sort of blow everything up and try this completely radical new approach, they're the ones who have to demonstrate that they've got the evidence to support it. And they don't. They just simply don't have the evidence. We do have a number of activist studies that are seriously flawed in their methodology, and those who are behind them have sort of either glaring ideological biases or conflict of interests, which are really not worth the paper that they're written on. But other than that, you know, it's just a total experiment treating these young children, these vulnerable young people, as guinea pigs, and it's unacceptable by normal standards, and we wouldn't tolerate it in any other field of medicine.
Let's talk about how states have responded to this. Different legislatures have taken different approaches. There have been certain states that have prohibited medical alterations of sex characteristics of minors. When you look at the states, I even think there are certain states right now that are looking at legislation to ban medical procedures on minors in relation to gender identity. Tell us a little bit about the states and how they're battling it out.
So, as often happens in American politics, this becomes a culture war issue. And so the states that have banned these practices generally correspond, if not exclusively correspond, with Republican majorities. And likewise, the states where it's encouraged are Democratic majorities. And of course, this results, as you mentioned in the introduction, this results in a patchwork of conflicting legislation, which is a problem. It's a problem, especially when you consider laws that allow so-called trans tourism. That's when a minor and potentially their family go from one state where it's outlawed to another state, and taxpayers in that other state, that blue state, fund these procedures. There's a other strain of this, of course, which is the attempt from the left to outlaw the alternative to so-called gender affirmation, which are those tried and tested, safe therapies we were talking about, the talk therapies. And the way that they do this is they have conversion therapy bans. And it's very cynical, dishonest use of the term. Conversion therapy really was used to refer to historic abuse of homosexuals in clinical settings. That has not been within the mainstream of psychiatric practice for decades now. Yes, you will find occasionally practices, maybe certain religious groups or whatever, but even those are not, they're not common. Very, very rarely do I see anybody pointing to evidence that this is a widespread problem in the United States when they're talking about it. And what they do is they conflate that historic abuse with these tried and tested talk therapies for children and trying to help them accept their biology, affirming their biology, affirming their bodies and saying, hey, listen, you're fine just as you are. You don't need to be making these radical changes to your body. Such a common sense approach. And yet it's being outlawed in many places through this manipulation of the term conversion therapy.
And one of the fascinating sides of this that I see is really the battle over what is referred to as parental rights. And so let's say you have a family that's in a blue state where, let's say, the family doesn't want their child to go through any type of drugs or medical treatments for gender dysphoria, and then they could be accused of child abuse in certain states. And then you have in other states, you have parents who do want their child to go through the cross-sex hormones and the surgeries, but they're in a conservative state that says that that's banned. Talk to me a little bit about this tug of war of parental rights.
Yeah, so Americans are a rights-based culture, and they're very sensitive to rights claims. And so I think naturally parental rights, which are covered in the 14th Amendment, are taken very seriously by both sides. I would say that, first of all, it is just, again, just a common, even if you want to take a step back from the rights approach and you want to look at safeguarding, that is, the community effort to keep children safe. Everybody knows that, except for very egregious cases where the parents are the suspected abusers, the best people to take part in the safeguarding of children are their own parents, right? And so if something's happened at school, if a child is confused about their sex, you bring the parents in. That's just common sense. It's really important to do that because, you know, we know that parents are less likely to be abusers than somebody who's unrelated to the child. So that's just a common sense approach. Now, I would say that there's a limit to how useful it is to talk about these rights, in that I think that some conservatives have tried to basically turn this around and say, okay, well, if gender affirmation is child abuse, which I agree, then we should be punishing parents who are seeking this out for their children. I think that's a big tactical mistake. I think that if you make this illegal for doctors to do, then parents can dress their child up as the opposite sex. Okay, fine. Like, they can treat them as the opposite sex. That's a bad idea, but, you know, there's not going to be the same types of damage than if you have surgeries and drugs. But if you just stop, if you outlaw the surgeries and drugs, then it doesn't become a parental rights thing. Because at a certain point, you know, yes, parental rights are key in this, and they're a very important part of this, especially if you look at what's going on in schools and also in custody battles. Parental rights have a very strong role in the safeguarding of children. But the fundamental issue here is the safeguarding of children. Right. And ultimately, you know, I think this is something that came up in the Republican presidential primary debates, where somebody sort of threw this back at Ron DeSantis and said, well, what about the parental rights of the parents who want to transition their children? And he said, parents do not have a right to have these procedures which are abusive, right? And I think that's a key point here, is that this is fundamentally about protecting children from abuse, and their parents have a very important role in that. But ultimately, the focus here has to be on transparency and holding the medical community accountable, because that is where this is happening.
And it's not just the states that are battling this out. The federal government has gotten involved as well. Talk to me a little bit about how Medicaid fits into this and how the overall federal government is intervening.
Yeah, so as with a lot of these issues, somebody's got to pay for it. And the Biden administration would like to have this available through the Affordable Care Act. And the way that they want to do that is by redefining discrimination on the basis of sex to include gender identity. And when you do that, you will have hospitals, insurers, all without the ability to say, no, we don't want to do this. This is not in best interest of our patients. Maybe even this, you know, goes against our conscience. And so that's another area where Republicans are really having to fight to keep this something that the taxpayer isn't liable for, fight to keep this so that this, again, dishonest definition of discrimination, just like we saw with conversion therapy, is not widened to the point that it includes all of these other things which are objectionable and there isn't the evidence base for.
And I want to focus a little bit on that, because if gender identity is added into regulations, is added into the law, you are then forcing a doctor to perform sexual reassignment surgery, even if they don't want to? And how do they reconcile that? I'm sure you hear this from doctors all the time. How do they reconcile that with the Hippocratic Oath of first do no harm?
Well, yeah, and this is something that's been a big problem with Catholic hospitals, is that they in particular have a very strong religious sense that you don't mess with somebody's biological sex because it's God-given. But even if you didn't have a religious basis for this, you could actually just have this as a view in a medical view, a professional view. And so, yes, you are exposing people to the risk that they're going to be losing their jobs, that they're going to be facing lawsuits because they won't provide these so-called treatments that are anything but. And I think what helps these people in making their defense is that they now can point to places in Europe, secular medical governing bodies that are saying, hey, we don't think we have the evidence base for this. We don't think we should be doing this. It's nothing to do with discrimination. It's about scientific and medical integrity and actually about the patient's welfare.
And before you go, just real quickly, I know that we have short-term studies, not necessarily long-term studies of what we've seen in the past 10 years in the United States, where you do have children going on puberty blockers so early. Again, the cross-sex hormones, and then the medical intervention, changing the bodies medically, even though you and I agree you can never really change somebody's biology or their sex. When do we have proof of long-term studies? How many years is that? And if you could touch us real quickly, because I think this is an important part too, we're already seeing lawsuits, correct?
Yes. So in terms of the studies, so if you take, there was a 2011 Swedish study where they did long-term follow-up over course of actually was like between 15 and 30 years. So they did a really long-term follow-up. And that was the definitive study that was used in part as the rationale to shut down sex change surgeries at Johns Hopkins University, because they followed these adults and found that actually their suicidality was going up after these surgeries. Now, in terms of when will we have these types of studies available for children undergoing gender dysphoria, I mean, This is still a relatively novel thing. I mean, it has been going on for 5 to 10 years now in a big way in the United States. But I think we're still going to have to wait, and we shouldn't have to wait, because obviously people are being harmed in the meantime, for anything definitive on that basis. Certainly in the UK, and the National Health Service has done its own sort of follow up of patients, and again concluded, we don't have evidence that this is making things better. But what we do have, and you alluded to with your mention of lawsuits, is we do have this growing group of people known as detransitioners. These are people who had these surgeries, took these drugs, and after doing so, wanted to go back because they realized it hadn't solved their underlying issues. And actually, maybe they would be happier after all with living the sex that they were born with. And these people have been very outspoken about the harms that they've faced. Some of the stories are just heartbreaking. If you hear about sort of glaring underlying issues, young teenage girls who had been sexually abused and they were sort of put on the conveyor belt. People who had maybe been bullied for being gay and thought this was a way out. I mean, it's really, really hard to hear. But it's important that we hear them. And these are the types of people who will be able to sue. I mean, there needs to be work done to make it easier for them to do so, things to do with statute of limitations and so forth. But you're definitely seeing that already in the United Kingdom. You're seeing mass malpractice lawsuits against that gender youth clinic, the main NHS gender youth clinic. And that really is moving the needle, because this is a story about harms, and you really need the victims to speak and to share those harms.
Yeah, it really is a story of child abuse. We've been so fortunate to have on this show a few detransitioners sharing their story. It's brave for them to tell their story, and so much has happened to them. But I'm thankful for people like you who do research this and put the information out there. Again, for our listeners, the policy focus is called The Current State of Laws Governing Gender Transitions. Madeline Kern, Senior Fellow at IWF, thank you so much for your work on this and for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for joining us. Before you go, IWF does want you to know that we rely on the generosity of supporters like you. Investment in IWF fuels our efforts to enhance freedom, opportunity, and well-being for all Americans. So please consider making a small donation to IWF by visiting IWF.org iwf.org/donate. That's iwf.org/donate. And last, if you enjoyed this episode of She Thinks, do leave us a rating or a review. It does help. And we love it if you share this episode so your friends can know where they can find more She Thinks. From all of us here at IWF, thanks for watching.